So let's start with what we already know, or should know. Okay, so the review, we're looking at induced EMF. Okay, and we are going to do this in a variety of ways. So the first thing we saw was motional EMF. We have a bar that we're moving through a magnetic field. That produces a potential difference across the ends of the bar. If I connect it to a circuit, I can get some current flowing, say, through this resistor. All right, the bar has a length L. It's moving with some velocity. And with this V perpendicular to the field, the way it's drawn, we get E is equal to VBL. Okay, where the script E is the EMF, or potential difference, okay, between these two endpoints. Now, in order to understand some of these things, we introduced magnetic flux, capital phi, which is given by BA cosine phi. So the idea is that I have some area that I'm looking at, and we know the magnetic field lines pierce that area, and we have want some way of representing how many arrows pierce that. So you can think about shooting a bunch of arrows in this direction. You can think about rainfall as you're driving into it, it's hitting rain your windshield. Okay. Or you can think of some of these old movies like Spartacus, okay, where these guys are all huddled and they have their shields over their head to protect them from all the arrows that are being fired at them. Okay. So we've got these arrows piercing. If the area is parallel to the field, okay, then none of the arrows are going to affect it. If it's perpendicular to the field, you get the maximum flux. So that's what's captured by this. We usually indicate the direction of that area or that plane that I'm representing in terms of its normal. So if I have a plane like this, right, I draw a normal so that I, as this thing is moving, I can see how the normal or the perpendicular moves with it. Right. So the phi is actually the angle between the normal and the magnetic field. So that's the standard for defining magnetic flux. And essentially, induced EMF results when I have a change in flux and time. So we talked about this a little bit the other day. How do I get a change in flux? We could change the magnetic field. So in this particular case, I could have the bar sitting there, and I can crank the field up. I could reverse direction of the field, right? All of those would have an effect as long as it's changing. And as long as it's changing, I can get current to flow in this loop. Okay. The other thing I can do is change the area. And that's essentially what the motional EMF is doing. Because what I could do is consider the following. If I move that rod over to this location, I now have an area, right? I get a change in area as I go from here to here. Therefore, I have a change in flux. And if I put that change in flux per change in time in the Faraday's law, put n equal 1 because I have one loop, then I should get this formula back as well. Because I can represent this area as delta x L. Okay, and then the flux in here for this particular problem, or actually the change in flux, is just going to be magnetic field times the area. Okay, the area in this case is delta x times L. Cosine phi. What is phi for this? The area basically is the area of this loop. Magnetic field is pointing in this direction. What's the direction is the normal pointing in? Same direction. So we can come in here and say that the cosine is 1. That gives me my delta phi. If I take delta phi, divide by delta t, I get delta x over delta t, and delta x over delta t is, in this case, the change in x per time is just v. So I can derive this from Faraday's law. So it's really just a consequence. It's not really something completely different. Yes?
Where did you say the normal was on that one? I guess I'm kind of confused at determining what the normal was.
For this?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So let's imagine, here's my loop. Right? Which way is the normal pointing? Which way is the perpendicular pointing to this boulder? Either this way or that way, right? It's perpendicular to the boulder. Right? Remember, normal is perpendicular.
Okay.
And this is the area I'm considering. The magnetic field's going through this. Okay? Are you all right with that?
I think so. So which way are we going in or out? Or do you have to jump?
Yeah, one or the other. I haven't actually told you why we would pick one over the other. At this point, it doesn't matter. It really has something to do with the direction the current's going to be in there, but that, we can do that with a right-hand rule. Yes?
So if the force was going right or left, then it would be parallel to the loop? Is that how that works?
If what force? If the force is going, which force are you thinking about? Are you thinking about the bar?
I guess the magnetic field.
Okay, so if I have this loop sitting here, but the field is going in this direction.
Right.
Okay, that's a good question. What's going to happen? Nothing. Right? The field is not penetrating that, right?
Right.
So in that particular case, I have my loop. Here's my area. The magnetic field's going this way. There are no arrows piercing the area. So the flux is 0. And no matter how much I move the bar, how fast I move the bar, nothing's going to happen.
Okay.
So these are the things we need to think about. Right? We're not concentrating so much on the equation. We're thinking about what's going on in the physics. I mean, this is the amazing stuff that people discovered in the 1800s. Right? That changing magnetic fields can produce electric fields, and changing electric fields can produce magnetic fields. Okay, those are the kinds of things we're seeing, and we're just seeing a simple way of computing some of this for very simple situations, such as my areas are planes. I'm not talking about what would happen if I'm looking at the areas piercing a sphere. That gets a little more complicated. We need some calculus in order to do that. All right. Those who have some calculus know that usually in calculus what you'll do is focus on little small areas. If I have a sphere like the Earth, right, it's pretty flat where I'm standing, right? If I don't look at the whole sphere. So I can break the sphere up into little chunks of little planes, right? Add up all the piercings through each of those and then come up with a result. We're just doing simple stuff. But you can visualize how you can look at things small and piece them together in such a way. And the piecing together is where the calculus comes from. All right. Things like integration for those that have had some calculus. All right, so that's the flux. Here's Faraday's law. As I said, I could change B, I could change A, and we also noted that we could change the angle. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Lenz's law. Okay, if I am experiencing a changing flux, okay, that can induce an EMF, and that EMF, if I connect it to a circuit, could give me an induced current. And then the idea is, which way does the induced current flow? And Lenz's law tells me that the induced current, okay, flows in such a way that the magnetic field it produces, okay, opposes the changing flux. So we did a couple examples of that. All right, moving on. The next type of an example is a generator. Okay, we've already seen motors. What is a generator? Essentially, let's see, I've got some magnets. So I can create a uniform magnetic field. And I have a loop that's sitting in here. And there's a shaft. And this loop is connected to some electrical appliance or something, or a battery, or to charge a battery, or whatever. The idea is that this loop, okay, is attached to a shaft, and I make it rotate. What happens when that loop rotates through the magnetic field? Okay, as we go through that. So I have a loop, maybe here's a loop. Okay, well, this is actually a coil. Right now I'm doing a single loop, right? And we'll beef that up to something like this where you have several coils. And the idea is that this thing is going to rotate around a shaft. I don't have a shaft going through it. Maybe it's easier this way, more stable. But that's the idea. I rotate this. So at this point, the magnetic field's pointing in this direction. Okay? What's phi? Little phi, not big phi.
Zero.
Okay, 0 degrees, because the normal is pointing in that direction, right? In fact, I could just use these knobs here to be my normal, but you can see them, right? So here's the magnetic field. There are the knobs. I rotate this. What do we get? We have an angle between the normal and the magnetic field, an angle that's not a non-zero angle, right? So as I rotate, now, what's the flux through this now? If the field's coming toward me, here, zero. Maximum, zero. Somewhere in between, it's changed, right? So all I'm doing is changing it. I'm not taking the area of the loop and changing the area. Okay, I'm not cranking up the magnetic field. I'll keep the magnetic field constant. Of course, you can imagine I don't have to do that. For this example, we're just going to keep a constant uniform magnetic field. And as this is turning around, what's the result? I have a changing flux. What's going to happen with this loop with a changing flux? Okay, essentially what's going on is that this particular piece of the loop, in the rectangular case, it's easier to visualize these rectangular pieces. Along that piece, that's the piece that's moving through the field. This is moving, so what I can do is get a current flowing through that. Because you can think of this rod moving through the magnetic field, much like this is, there's a potential difference established in both of the vertical pieces, and with that potential difference connected to a circuit, I get current flowing. Okay? So, what do we have? How do I get this to turn? I do mechanical work. So mechanical work right, I connect this to some kind of crank or something. Okay, or I connect it to something that's moving on my car that's been driven by gasoline. And that mechanical work gets converted to electrical energy. So that's what a generator does. On the other hand, a motor does the reverse. Right? With the motor that we had before, what we had done was that we had forced current up and around the loop. It was in a magnetic field, and the torque that was produced causes it to rotate, and I then can use that mechanical energy of rotation, okay, to do work. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Of course, I want to do a little bit more than that, but before I do that, I actually brought something in that I have here is a crank. You can see these black bars. What do they look like? So there's three magnets, and if you could see in here, as I turn that a little bit, you can see that there's some coils in there. Okay, and that's the basic idea, and we know what this is. Right?
Somebody said no.
And let's see. And it doesn't work.
Well, it was working then.
A couple minutes ago.
Wasn't even put together. It helps when the wires don't come off.
Right, like all demonstrations, they don't. So it worked the first time. Bad enough that the bulb was not even attached to this one. I don't think it is. Okay, so we believe it, right? But now we know how it works. Okay, now you can build your own. Okay. All right, I also brought in a coil just so you could see a real live coil. Right? This is a solenoid because it's a bit longer than this actual coil here. This is the kind of loop that we went through and computed with the magnetic field was at the center. Okay, this is our solenoid. There's a magnetic field along the center here that we can compute. Okay. So, all right, so what is the induced EMF? Can I figure out what the EMF is in this problem? So this is along a shaft. This shaft is called an armature. Somebody talks to you about the armatures and your generators. Okay, what I'd like to do is compute the EMF. That's induced. Let's say I take one of these vertical pieces. That vertical piece is actually moving through a magnetic field, similar to this. Okay, so we can use the magnetic field times L times V. Except you have to be a little bit careful with the V. Okay, if I'm looking down on this, the V, which is the perpendicular component of V, not the parallel component, to the field. So if you sit here, you can draw a perpendicular and play with right triangles and find out the part that I want that's perpendicular is opposite the V. Okay, opposite makes us think of sines, right? And so it's just V sine phi. So that's what the EMF looks like. Except in something like this, I have more than one coil, so we could throw in N loops and extend that to N loops. And so that's just going to be N times 2BL sine phi. 2BLV sine V. Now it turns out this isn't quite the useful form that I want. Okay. But nonetheless, if I know what the angle is, I can tell you what the induced EMF is at that moment. Why? What's happening in this? It's rotating. What's happening in the feet? It's changing. Okay? Now, another way one could approach this is say, oh, well, I already know how to compute the flux. I can put the flux in here. The only thing that's changing is the angle. So I would get something like the flux is NB area times the change in the cosine per time. Problem is, we don't know what the change in the cosine per time is in this class because I need calculus. All right, for very small times, for those that have had calculus, all this is I need to know how to differentiate the cosine. All right, for the other people that all know calculus, we're doing it this way. The result will be the same. Except one of the things we have to figure out is how does phi depend upon time? So what I'm looking at is I'm looking at this loop, right, and it's rotating. A point on this loop is going around, right? Well, this loop is actually circular. This is not circular for our demonstration, but our end result will apply to this. So as that's rotating, I just follow a point, okay, say on this bar, and that's going around in a circle. Over and over, right? Rotational motion. Now, I'm assuming you've seen some rotational motion in physics one. Okay, if I have an object going around, what's nice about this rotational motion is it's a constant angular speed. Okay, so what I could do is phi, well, back when you were doing circular motion, you were doing thetas, right? And you would have something like kinematics. Remember, kinematics says that the position as a function of time for a constant acceleration problem, the position would be something like, you know, x is equal to x0 plus vt, etc., right? Plus an acceleration term. No acceleration, I can just stop the vt. For the angular acceleration, I could have an initial position. So at t equals 0, right, this is at angle phi 0. And then I can let it go through with a speed times time, where omega is the angular speed. Does this look familiar? Okay, so I've got this thing going around and around. Now I'm going to make life easy. I'm going to assume, like we do often, that I start my clock when the angle is 0. So if t is equal to 0, that would get rid of that. So now phi is omega t. That just makes life easier. So the angle in here is actually a function of time. So I can see this going around as a function of time. I can tell you what the angular position is if I know what omega is. Okay. How do I change omega? Right, I have to rotate the coil faster. Okay. So now I can replace phi with omega t. The other thing is, since this is circular motion, I'm looking down, following that point on the rod. So here's a point. I'm following that as it's going around. It has, actually, v is the tangential velocity. This is going around with an angular velocity of omega. And we know that there is a relationship between the angular velocity and the tangential velocity. What is the relationship between v and omega? One more letter.
Is it RW?
Say what?
Or R omega?
R omega. Good. Where R, of course, is the radius. This V that I'm looking at here is actually the V that's in the formula. What I'm attempting to do here is put this in angular terms. OK? Okay, I've already got phi written in terms of omega. What I'm going to do is write v in terms of omega. Next thing is, let's say that the width of the loop is w. Right, and the L that I have here is actually the height of the loop. So what is R?
1/2 W.
Now this is, well, I'm following the notation of the text. It's one of those rare occasions where omega and W are in the same equation. We're on the board, even on the board at the same time. So you have to be careful. W should really be pointy. Omega is a curve. This is not a W, by the way. An omega is a difference. Okay, I can stick all that in there. So therefore, see what I have so far. I have that the induced EMF is the number of turns, 2BLV sine phi, but 2 times V. Just gets rid of this 2. So I could write that as N B L W omega. Did I get everything? Up to the sine. And then sine, and then I'm going to stick in omega T. Now remember, this is all together. You cannot pull the omega out of the sine. Some people try to do in the homework. Omega, by the way, is actually 2 pi times the frequency. So we've already seen 2 pi ft this semester. And that's the frequency. Frequency, what are the units of frequency f?
Hertz.
Or 1 over seconds. All right? 2 pi, that's actually 2 pi radians. So the units of omega are radians per second. It's like converting from cycles per second to radians per second. Okay, is the ratio of the relationship here. Okay, let's see, what else can I do? LW. I'm not quite done. What's LW?
Area.
Ah, so now I got this in a form that is somewhat invariant or somewhat not changing if I change my square loop into a circular loop. But again, that has to be proven. All right, so that's NBA, not the National Basketball Association. NBA, what am I missing? Omega sine omega T. So number of loops, B times the area. And guess what? If I had written here cosine omega T, and those bright people that know how to differentiate, if you differentiate this, get the same thing I get. Up, well, up to a minus sign, but that gets canceled with this minus sign. All right, so anyway, this is the form. That's a constant. If I were to plot this, what do I have? Well, this is a, right, for a constant omega. I have a sine function. Sine, we know, goes up and down, right? The number out in front of here, what do we call that before? When we plot sines?
Amplitude.
Right, so this is the amplitude. That amplitude has the same units as this. So basically, that's the peak voltage from the generator. So I could just replace that. And there's the form from my generator that's coming out. So as I crank this up with my mechanical energy, I am actually producing an oscillating voltage, right? I have an AC generator. Now that I have an AC generator, I can use this in the next chapter. Okay. All right, so that's what changing the angle allows us to do. Okay, produce generators. And we can, as I said, we can do the reverse kind of thing. I can talk about motors, okay, which for a motor we push current through here, and then that causes a torque and it rotates. Now, one of the things that happens when we do that is going to the motor case, okay, we supply a current, this loop rotates, but it's rotating in a magnetic field. What does that tell you? If the loop's rotating in a magnetic field, what's going to happen? It's going to generate current. All right? Lenz's law, there's a changing magnetic field. A changing flux, right? And so that changing flux is, by Lenz's law, going to induce a current. And it's going to induce a current to oppose the changing flux, which means it's going to produce a current in the opposite direction of the current that I'm supplying. So if I have a motor and I'm supplying current that's going up like this, that's going to cause it to rotate, there's going to be a changing flux, and there's going to be a current in the other direction, which typically is less. Okay? And so in motors, we have what's known as a back EMF. This is especially noticed when we're doing things like building our own little motors, science fair projects and things. You build a motor and you get this 9-volt battery, and before you know it, the battery's dead because it's taken so much to conquer this back EMF and make things work. So. All right, so that's the notion of back EMF. So if you think about it long enough, you will see that if I do have a motor, if I force a current this way, there's going to be a back current, a small back current going the other way. So, and if that has a particular resistance in it, the total current, of course, is going to be less. Very similar to writing down equations for the internal resistance of the battery. All right, so there's another concept in this chapter. Something called inductance. There are two types of inductance. The first is mutual inductance. Okay. So the idea of mutual inductance is the following. I have an AC source. I'm going to connect this to a coil. And so let's see. The coil, and then I'm going to wrap this around. Backwards compared to how I was going to draw it. That's fine. And then I have a second coil. Okay, so for this second coil, I'm going to connect this, say, a voltmeter. And so let's see. By now you're used to using voltmeters in the lab. So in this case, I'm driving some current through. There's going to be a magnetic field produced. That magnetic field is going to be seen by this coil. And then we're going to see a current in the field. So that's the idea. If I just had a battery with a switch, we saw that the other day, that we would only see something happen for an instant, right? But now that I can use an AC source, right? What this means is this is constantly changing. The current's constantly changing, right? And so sometimes the current's going around this way, sometimes it's going around that way, right? So sometimes the field's pointing in that direction, sometimes in this direction. If it's pointing in this direction, the strength is going to be varying, right? So it's going to go up to a maximum, then it's going to decrease, and then it's going to change direction. Then it's going to get a maximum magnitude. Then it decreases, and then it changes, right? So it flips, right? Stronger, weaker, but this way or that way, all right? So you can see, okay? Definitely, the second coil is going to see a change in flux. So therefore, there's going to be an induced EMF in here, and I should be able to measure the voltage. Okay, so that's the basic idea in the setup. And what I want to do is think about this. Well, since there's a changing flux, I can tell you that the EMF is going to be related to the changing flux. But in reality, we don't measure flux. Okay, types of things we measure are voltage and current. So what is the flux, changing flux, depend upon? Well, it depends upon area. Well, this area is not changing. Angle, the angle's not changing. The only thing that's changing is the magnetic field, right? To see the magnetic field getting stronger, weaker, changing signs. Okay. What do we know about the field? Well, that field that's being produced in here depends on what? This is a solenoid. What's the magnetic field inside a solenoid? Remember that?
Number of the
mu zero. There's a mu zero. I got that one. Little n.
Big I.
So the magnetic field in here depends on the current. Number of turns per length is not changing. Mu zero is a constant, so the only thing I've got left is the current, right? Current's changing. So indirectly, the EMF in here, really, it should be proportional to the change in the current. Okay? And that's where we're headed. All right, so since this is the one that's coil, primary solenoid, whatever. And this one I'm going to call that the secondary coil. The current that's coming out in the calculation is the primary current. So the primary change in the primary current over here is going to produce an EMF in the secondary coil. And that's what we're interested in. What is the EMF in the secondary coil? Okay, and so that's the basic idea. So this is going to give me that the EMF in the secondary coil is proportional to, okay, well, the change in the current. So that's actually the change per time. Okay, which is coming out of Faraday's law. Okay, so the EMF that I get, now remember, what is the EMF? What are the units?
Volts.
Volts. So I'm going to be measuring the voltage here. Actually, what voltage should I be measuring? Should I be measuring the peak voltage or something else?
Yeah.
What is the ultimate measure?
The root mean square.
Say what?
Is it the RMS?
It's the RMS voltage, right? The mean, the root mean square, the average. So what this will really measure is going to be the average. But since this is slashing back and forth, that's going to be, right? We're going to have this slashing back and forth as well. Okay. But the voltmeter is actually going to measure the RMS value. Okay, but I'm not going to go all the through all those details. The important thing is that the, I mean, the secondary EMF, which is what I'm talking about, is going to be proportional to the change in the current in the primary. Okay. So that's what we're after. And we can find out exactly what that is. It turns out that the secondary EMF is just going to be some constant. We'll call that M times the change in IP per change in T. M is the mutual inductance. So this is the basic idea. I actually haven't computed what M is or gone quite as much depth as I can or will go. But to just to give you the idea, right? You've got the picture, right? We got changing over here. Okay, we have the current that's fluctuating, it's oscillating, it's causing a changing flux that's seen by this. This sees a changing flux, therefore there'll be an induced EMF. Boom. That's what it is. The idea is the induced EMF can be written in terms not of flux, but it could be written in terms of the current in the primary. And the constant that comes out has a name. It's called the mutual inductance. This mutual inductance has units. So in SI units, this is given by H, which stands for Henry, which is actually a last name of a famous person back in the 1800s. Not the first name. Okay. So that's the basic idea. The idea now is to look at maybe some details. So if I were to think about this, essentially the net flux in the second coil and I've already basically said this, has to do with the number of, now we have to get down to the fact that these may have different numbers of coils. Okay, so NS is the number of turns of secondary coil. And then I can take that times the flux in the secondary coil. As I've already seen, the flux in the secondary coil is related to the magnetic field in the primary coil. So this is proportional to the magnetic field in the primary coil. So I'm just summarizing what I did there. That, in general, is proportional to, these are proportional to the current. That's just a quick summary of what I said, because maybe this is not quite a solenoid, but some, okay, and maybe we have to adapt that for something more special, but I am just thinking in terms of solenoids, and so it's fine for us to just think in terms of solenoids for these problems. Okay, so we know that if I go and look at the change in flux, it has to do with the change in the current, so that's pretty much everything I said. If I wanted to, I could write Faraday's law for the secondary coil is minus the number of turns in the secondary coil times the change in flux per change in time. So if I'm careful, right, that secondary coil sees a change in flux per change in time. Okay. And if I assume, and this is an assumption, okay, that this proportionality is just a proportionality with a constant, this is where I can actually define M. So I could just say this is MIP. So the book introduces M at that stage. I actually introduce it at the end. Okay, but sometimes it's useful to know that the Mutual inductance times the current is equal to the number of turns times the flux. So if I go in and I take NSV here and I replace that with MIP, I get what I wrote already. Okay, so this implies that I get the equation I've already divided. So this is the way the book goes about it. It says, all right, we do this, we know the proportionalities, well, I introduce an M at this level instead of a little bit later when I did it. Okay. So either way is appropriate. So I have two coils, I have mutual inductance, one right, to measure how one influences another. Now it actually turns out that I don't need two coils. I can have one coil. And just get rid of this coil and think about one coil by itself. What's happening is I'm putting an AC source across this coil. There's a change in flux, right? So this coil sees a change in flux. What's going to happen to the coil itself? There's going to be an induced EMF, so as to oppose the flux by Lenz's law. So actually, if I just have one coil, okay, we can get what's called self-inductance. So instead of this one interacting with that one, it's interacting with itself. So for self-inductance, we have something very similar. In this case, I don't have to use sub S or sub P's. We know that I can take the number of turns and multiply it times the current, and that's, what am I doing here? Let's take the number of turns times the flux. So I'm going to do the same thing I did here, and I can think to myself, just like we did before, all right, I have a certain number of turns times the flux. The flux is going to change. What does the flux depend upon? Well, I have a changing flux here. That's going to induce an EMF, but that EMF that it induces is going to be related to the field that's changing. The field is proportional to the current. So we do the same analysis, but I only have one coil. So the point is that the N times the flux is going to be proportional to the current. In this case, again, there's only one current, so I don't need a sub P. Proportionality, what we did before was we plugged in, we plugged in a proportionality constant of an inductance term, M. But self-inductance comes with its own letter, L. So L is the self-inductance and it's measured in Henry's, obviously. Of course, if I look at this, I can tell, right, N is just the number of turns. That's not really a unit. That's not a basic SI unit, right, like mass, length, time, charge. So what I have here is V, a unit of flux, which is basically Tesla meter squared, right, if you look at the units of flux, divided by current. So a Henry is really given by 1, just solve for L, 1 flux unit, which is a Tesla meter squared, divided by a current unit, which is amps. But again, if we just stick with SI units and make sure everything, right, if I have milliamps converted to amps and all that, all right, then my unit automatically is a Henry. Now, for the case of a solenoid, we could actually find out what L is. All right, so I have this solenoid. I'm going to put a source across it, okay? And I can start computing. So for a solenoid, I have B is equal to mu zero Ni. That's the magnetic field. Faraday's law tells me that the induced EMF is minus the number of turns times the change in phi per change in time. If I plug into this what phi is, this is the change in, well, what is the flux? The flux is just BA cosine phi, right? Cosine phi is 1 in this particular case, right? We have these coils, the fields are in this direction, right? And so as I'm changing my flux, I've got B in this direction that's changing perpendicular to a coil. So as it changes, it's going to cause an induced EMF. Okay, but that perpendicular means cosine phi is 0. So that's just BA. So B is mu 0 Ni times the area. So that's the flux. Right? For each coil. Right? And there's N of. What's changing? Well, the only thing that's changing is I. That's the whole point of this discussion of inductance. Right? So if I'm just looking at one coil, all right, the only thing that's going to change in that formula is the current. So all this other stuff is constant. So if I were to write this as the final value minus the initial value, I can factor out a mu zero and the little n, and I can factor out the a. So this is minus n mu zero little n a. Did I get all this stuff out except for the I? So that's delta I delta t. And in fact, this takes the right form. EMF is proportional to delta I delta t. And the proportionality constant here is L. Just like before, the proportionality constant was M. I'm just replacing M with L. Two coils, one coil. So that tells me that this L value, why don't we give this cell a name? This is called the inductance, right? The self-inductance. Well, the self-inductance exists, you know, wasting all that energy. Calling it self-inductance, we just call it inductance. Okay, we really mean self-inductance. But we see the inductance, and, right? Really, we just have one coil. And we can take coils like this and put them in circuits, and such a coil is called an inductor. It's going to give us our next circuit element that we can use in the next chapter. All right, so the inductance for a solenoid is just this thing. But guess what? N and little n are related, aren't they? Little n is big N divided by the number of turns, or the length, right? It's the number of turns per length. So let's see. Little n is equal to big N divided by L. L, except there's a problem. I already have an L. Well, we'll make it a little L. So we don't get confused between inductance and length, or maybe not as confused as we could be. All right, so there are different ways of doing this. I could replace little n with this expression, or I could solve this for big N and make it in terms of little n. So big N is what? Little n times little l, so we'll do that. Put little n times this, that's going to give me an n squared, so that's actually going to be mu zero n squared little l a. So for a solenoid with n terms per length, little n, cross-sectional area, length L, I can tell you what the inductance is. But again, the key here is that script E is equal to minus a constant delta I over delta T. So the Faraday's law now is written in terms of current. In these two cases, the first case I had two coils, the second case I have one coil. And that's all inductance is. Now these inductors are nice because what they do is they store magnetic energy. Stores electrical energy. Well, that might be equivalent to this. A capacitor. Right? Capacitors store electrical energy. Inductors store magnetic energy. And so one can go through a discussion about what that energy storage is. So what's going on here is, okay, that we have charge that's being the coil. Okay? And here we know if you're going to push charge through fields, chances are you've got to do some work. Alright? So you can compute the amount of work that's done, and the book does that. And I'm not going to go through into too much detail. It turns, because again, I'm going to have to wave my hands and tell you you've got to know some calculus. Okay? But the basic idea is that the energy is given by 1/2 Li squared. So if I have current going through this coil, it takes basically this much work. Okay, so that's how much energy that I can store. Noting that the current for a solenoid is proportional to B, okay, this is proportional to B squared. And you can work out the details. Just take this, solve for I, plug it in, okay, and you find that the current is proportional to B, the energy is proportional to B squared. And if you look back to a similar argument for capacitors, the energy stored there was proportional to E squared. Okay, and there's a similarity between these. And in fact, if I play with this enough, you'll see when I plug things in that I'll actually get a factor that's equivalent to the volume. The volume for my coil is nothing other than the length of the coil times the cross-sectional area. So there's a volume piece in here so that I can divide out and I can get the energy per volume or the energy density. So the book discusses that. We're not going to go into depth on that, but I will come back and refer to this in a few chapters. Okay. So these do store energy. This can be extrapolated, as we'll talk about later, to general magnetic fields and general electric fields, as far as how much energy content these fields have. All right, there's one more topic, and then we're done with the chapter, and this is transformers. So the idea is I can take two coils, like my coils there, and there are various ways you can represent these. Sometimes you can take a coil and then you can wrap another coil around it, right? Then you have two leads, so I can have a coil that's coming in like this, and then I can take another coil, wrap it around. These coils obviously will have fluxes that will interact, right? That's kind of sloppy looking, so sometimes what I'll
I'll just do this.
Okay, for my two coils. One of the coils is going to be the primary coil. And here's the secondary coil. In the primary coil, what I can do is I can set up, let's say this primary coil has N sub P for primary terms. And the secondary coil has N sub S. If I establish a potential difference across this one, or connect it to an alternating source, we've been putting script E here. And of course, the book does derivations. But normally, when one looks at the transformer equations, we stop writing the script E and we write V instead, so we can remember voltage. Right? So let's say that the voltage across this is VP. What's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen? There's one more piece in here. What do I need to write? Well, I could write current, but before I do that, right, if I have an alternating voltage on this coil, it's going to produce a changing magnetic flux. And if this is close enough to it, it will see that changing magnetic flux, even close like this. And therefore, there'll be an induced EMF over here. So that's what's missing, the induced EMF. This is a supplied EMF, here's the induced EMF, and that induced EMF is VS. Obviously, if these are connected to the circuits, the next step are currents, because then I can relate the current over here to the current over there. Okay, now these transformers are very useful. Okay, if I have power lines, that I'm running from a power station to a factory or to your house or whatever, right? But all of that current that's flowing over these long distances, and there's going to be an energy loss. I squared R. Alright? Those are pretty long lines, so maybe R is going to count. Alright? So I'm going to have some loss in electrical energy. How do I stop the loss? I keep I down. Right? So what do you have to do for a certain power? Well, let's see. If I want to keep my power constant, P is equal to IV. If I have a low I, I need a high V. So what I have to do is change. Of course, the high V is not what I want in my house. All right? So when I get to the house, I want to take any high V that I'm putting across these transmission lines and reduce it to a low V. So if I go from a high voltage to a low voltage, that's called a step-down transformer. That's what the transformers will do. It'll take a high voltage, we can step it down to a low voltage if I just construct the number of turns correctly. Okay, and so we have step-down and step-up transformers. Step-down, the voltage goes from high to low. Step-up, it goes from low to high. That should be pretty easy, right? So all I have to do now is ask a simple question. If I know the voltage coming in, and I know the number of turns here, and I know the number of turns there, can I tell you what the voltage is coming out? And the idea is relatively simple, because the voltage, okay, say from any of these, the voltage is going to be proportional to the change in flux per time. Okay? But if these are both, this is producing a change in flux per time, and that sees the same change in flux per time, then all I have to do, well, I really have to go down the Faraday's law. We have V is equal to minus N delta phi, delta t for the primary. We have Vp is Np. For the secondary, I have Vs is minus Ns delta phi delta t. If I eliminate the delta phi delta t here, well, I can do that very easy. I could use the eraser method. I could erase the Ns, bring them to the other side. Right? So V over N is a constant. Right? V over N is delta phi over delta t in both cases. So what that tells me between the two of these is Vp over Np is equal to Vs over Ns. And the reason I dropped the script E's is because it's the standard form for the transformer equations. That's the relationship between the voltages and the number of turns in the coils. So that's one of the simplest equations that we have. Okay. So if I want, I can go in and plug some numbers in. So it's almost the end. We got, what, 30 seconds? All right. So let's say over here I have, I don't know, 500 volts. And I have the number of turns here is very simply 100 turns. And what I really want here is something on the order, two of them real round numbers, quick computation. Let's say I want something on the order of, what, 100 volts. How many turns would I have to have in the secondary coil in order to do that? Right, so what do we have? 500 over 100. Let's see what. 500 over 100, that's the voltage over the number of turns, should be equal to the 100 that I want divided by, Ns. Okay? So what's the answer? And that's equal to what?
14.
Okay, I got a 20, I got a 0.2.
It's 14.
20 sounds boring. I like it. All right, this is 5. 5 into 100 is 20 turns. Okay, is this a step up or a step down transformer? Step down. Yeah. I mean, that's all there is to the transformer equation, right? It all just comes out of thinking about the flux changes and everything. But that's, I'm assuming these are in such a position that the change in flux that both of them see is the same. So that's a major assumption, I think. All right.